Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Adam Gordon Bell. Adam is a software engineer that loves building software and learning things. He is based in Peterborough, Canada, but works remotely with developers all over the world. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
So Adam, before we get started talking about some functional programming and other things, could we just maybe find out a little bit about you and how you kind of entered the industry and got started?
Sure. So I got started in high school, I think, when we had a class on Turbo Pascal, and we had to build like a Yahtzee game. We split up into teams, and I think me and my friend Jason, we ended up making this Yahtzee game with like ASCII graphics, and like it was so fun, just like building things, typing code, building games. So I guess I've been kind of chasing that for a long time, that feeling of just, you know, getting to create something fun. So then I went to university, got a CS degree, maybe didn't always appreciate some of the more abstract classes. But since then, you know, I left, you know, I worked in industry, and I think that now I'm sort of actually very interested in the things that I didn't like back when I was in university, the more, you know, the kind of deeper, more theoretical comp sci knowledge. I'm finding a lot of value in it. So that's a bit of my story, I guess.
So what are you doing these days?
So I work at Tenable, which is a security company, and I work on the application security team. Primarily, what we do is take Docker images and do static analysis of them to find security vulnerabilities.
Yeah, there was recently a headline in the news about what Alpine had a vulnerability, and that's primarily used in a lot of Docker containers. Did you guys have any part in that, or have you rectified that situation? Any tools that you might have that would help identify those types of things?
Yeah, well, we didn't cause the issue, to be clear, but. So we didn't have a role in it in that aspect, but we somebody on my team worked on basically a change to our static analysis to identify images that go through our system that have those affected Alpine versions, so that if you're using our product, then it will flag that, hey, you know, this version of Alpine you're using has this vulnerability. And actually it was a very wide sweeping vulnerability. Like Alpine is like just what people use because it's so small and so nice. So kind of a crazy one, actually. Oh, and I also have a podcast called Co-Recursive. And that's like an interview podcast where I kind of try to talk to experts about, you know, their area of expertise, and they try to teach me things, and hopefully the listeners like learn along with me.
Excellent. So what types of things have you learned from your guests?
That's a great question. So I have one coming up with this guy. I haven't released it yet, but I've done the interview with Bob Nystrom, and he wrote a book. Actually, he's not completed, called Crafting Interpreters. So he wrote a book about how you can build your own programming language, how you can build an interpreter for it, how you can build bytecode. He takes it a long ways. And so when I talk to him, he kind of walks me through these steps of like building your own programming language. And this gets back to a little bit to what I was saying about like reigniting some of this things that I learned in school, because like it turns out that like building like a basic like parser and stuff, it's not as hard as you might think. Like I think in a couple thousand lines of code, he builds like his own language. I think that this, like, it's funny. This while I was prepping for this, I had an issue at work, kind of like what we were describing. Like we have to look through security vulnerabilities and look at kind of what versions of things they apply to. And to actually do this, you end up with like long strings that's like, you know, if it's greater than 7 or less than 5 or equal to this or blah, 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 blah. And the way I had traditionally solved this is like using sort of regexes to pull them apart. But once I met with Bob, I realized like there is a whole field of CS about this, right? You can build a parser that's much more readable, much, much simpler, much easier to understand, that can handle these rules no problem. So it's an interesting case of like this academic area being very practical.
So did you write a parser to do some work instead of using regex?
I did, yeah. I wrote a parser. It's a recursive descent parser, which sounds very fancy. but it's actually not that hard to build a parser. I wasn't parsing the most complicated thing in the world, but there are precedence rules. You know, if you have greater than seven or less than five, like you kind of have to understand some precedence. And, I think it was just a couple hundred lines of code to kind of build this, and evaluate it. And I'll take 200 lines of parser code over 50 lines of just like regex after regex after regex. Any day.
And you have a fair amount of interest and knowledge in functional programming. Myself, I've been an object-oriented programmer for years and years and years, and really just done some high-level reading on functional programming. How'd you get involved in that, or how'd you develop an interest in functional programming?
Well, after I left university, I did a lot of... I did C# development, actually. It was like C# 1 and then I think 2 and 2.2. It's been quite a while, but and a lot of like line of business applications, like just business rules. And I did that for a long time. And, you know, I thought like I was really good at it, and that I thought that I basically understood everything there was to know, right? Like, and then I started to... try to teach myself Haskell, and discovered like that there was like an unending like world of just like very cool ideas to apply to abstracting and specifying kind of declaratively software that I'd never heard of. And I'm somebody who really likes to learn. So that was just kind of like I don't know, like nerd sniping for me, right? There was just an unending a number of things to learn after this and this and that. And then I had the opportunity. So I did try to get a job doing Haskell professionally, but there wasn't too many opportunities for that. But I did have to do some JVM work. And originally I just wasn't happy with Java when I started to use it, because like C#, they had kept like iterating on the language and adding features. And Java was like very slow, and like they didn't have like type inference and they didn't have all these things. So I found Scala and started working on that, which is a JVM language that tries to kind of unite object-oriented code and functional programming code. And I came to it just because it looked nicer than Java, right? I didn't really know a lot about it. But it was fabulous. So the fact that it let me kind of do things kind of as like, you know, maybe a more concise Java made me feel really at home, like I understood this language. But then it had a lot of advanced concepts that I slowly learned. Excuse me. So that's how I started that path. And I'm still on it, I guess.
So are you still using Scala then on a daily basis, or?
Yeah. Yeah, so I use Scala on a daily basis, and it's pretty niche, but my team that I'm on just loves it. And I feel like there's this thing that we call in functional programming like local reasoning. So if you write all your code so that like a function only takes in inputs and returns outputs, like there's no side effects, then when you're working on a problem, like all you need to understand is like this bit of code that you're currently looking at. Like there's not a bunch of, I remember debugging problems where like you just had to keep the whole state of the whole program in your head to understand what was going wrong, right? And functional programming kind of pushes you towards this local reasoning place where you just have to understand that little bit. And that is just, That is just a type of developer ergonomics that I can't give up now. Like, I feel like I don't know how I did it before when I had to understand how the whole program worked to figure out what was wrong here. But now I can like zoom into this part and say, like, I just need to understand this. Maybe I'm just getting older, but I feel like I'm too stupid to do non-functional programming now.
So is the local reasoning, is that related at all to the concept of pure functions? Like, is that?
Yeah.
So for anyone who doesn't know, could you tell us what a pure function is and maybe explain how that helps with the local reasoning?
Yeah. So a pure function is a function, I guess sort of in the mathematical sense, but basically it means that a function takes in some inputs and it produces some outputs. And then for any input, it must always produce the same output and it must not do anything else. So, I mean, this sounds simple, like 2 + 2, the plus is a function, it will always give you 4. But if you think of a lot of the programming we do, it doesn't necessarily hold up, right? Like when you do read line, like that returns different values every time. If you have a getter and a setter in an object, like each time you do a get, you could get a different value, like a different thread could be modifying the state or even the same thread. Basically, what that means is you have to take side effects and make them into effects. You have to, it's hard to explain in an audio format, but I think that one way to state it is just, it's a constraint on how you design software at the low level. And I think it's, at least in Scala, it's challenging to get more than, say, 90% of your code to be pure functions. But that forces you into a really nice design space where a lot of your code is just very simple, you know, processing and stuff, and could be easily tested. And then kind of at the edges, you have some stuff that does the more like reading from the user, writing to disk.
So you mentioned and said that the Scala sort of married functional and object-oriented a little bit. Could you talk a little bit more about that and maybe sort of contrast some of the differences between functional and object-oriented, or are these two concepts that really don't need to be exclusive of each other?
That's like a big question, I guess. So it's interesting because I came to Scala not for its functional programming, but the style that I tend to employ right now is almost primarily in that functional vein. So I think the big difference maybe would be in an object-oriented world, you are combining data with things that act on that data. So like an object contains state and, you know, things that can modify that state. In a functional world, you keep those totally separate. So functions basically act on bare data, and there's no coupling between these two. Is that helpful?
Yeah, and I think that is helpful. What are some of the ways that Scala can kind of, what about the language itself sort of really enables you or opens that world up for you?
There's a couple features that Scala has that are fairly unique. So first of all, like, I mean, most C# that you would want to write, you could write in Scala as is, maybe with some small syntactic changes. And of course, the libraries are going to be different. And you don't have semicolons, but like,
sure.
Generally in that spirit. But then it has a number of features that you probably a lot of people haven't seen. So one of those is higher kind of types. Higher kind of types is, I think, only found in Scala and Haskell and some derivatives. But if you think of generics, it used to be we didn't, you know, like Java and C# didn't have generics. They had like array lists that were, you know, untyped. And then somebody imported this concept from Haskell that they called, I think, parametric polymorphism, which was, you know, having, it's just the generics that we know and love, right? Like you can have a list of T. But see, the FP world didn't stop there. They kept on following this generic concept. So there's something called higher kind of types. Higher kind of types lets you take the generic genericness one level up. So where in C# you could have a list of T, I don't believe you can have like an L of T where neither one is specified. So a lot of the confusing things that you may hear about functional programming, I think, have to do with just other languages not having this concept as much. Like if I say parametric polymorphism, that sounds very fancy. but generics, I think people understand what they are. Like these concepts maybe aren't as foreign as they sound. But if you have higher kind of types, you start to be able to write like interfaces that can be very generic, right? You can write something that can be generic over a list, over a tree, over IO actions. Like they can all implement an interface that is the same. And that allows you to write some libraries that are just very, very flexible. So you start to get a really nice standard library that can abstract over a lot of common things.
Yeah, I think the closest you can get to that two-level generic is something like a function of T or an action of T in C#, because the function and action is just any method that takes in parameters of the right types. That's really cool. Kind of makes me wonder what I could create with that.
Yeah, so interesting. Your function of T is an interesting example, because like so like a monad is a very simple interface, but it uses higher kind of types. It just has two methods, and one of those methods is like bind and one is pure. It depends on the language. In Scala, it's flat map and pure, I think. But so a function can be an implementer of that. If a function of T can be a monad, but so can a list of T, and so can a tree, and so can an async action. So it's just I don't know if that makes sense, but it lets you abstract at a slightly higher level. You can think of like I don't know if this is going to make sense, but like link in C#, like you can add, I think you can write, you can add select many to other types, can you not?
It's on like IEnumerable and IQueryable, things like that. It's an extension method.
So if you could like add it to types that you don't own, that would be kind of getting at the concept, which I guess you can do with extension methods, but you wouldn't be able to like it's kind of we're kind of hinting at another Scala concept, which is called type classes, which kind of let you implement an interface from outside of it. But I feel like I might have gone too deep on a specific feature.
That's cool, nonetheless. I thought one of the other things that you mentioned was that that this really added a lot of, especially when you're talking about the local reasoning, yes, for the sort of benefits for testing. Could you talk a little bit more about that? Because that really makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So I feel like there's this thing, this phrase that I've heard sometimes targeted at me, which is like, if you know, if your code isn't easy to test, like it's not well written. So this is something that people say, right? But I feel like there's not much of a prescription there, right? It's just a diagnosis. They're just like, this code is bad. So I think the pure functions maybe is a more specific diagnosis. So if you're able to write your code in a way in which there is a single area where you pass in all the things it depends upon, and then a result comes out the other end, then that's going to be very easy to test, right? You don't have to mock things out. You don't have to, you know, provide stub versions of this and that. So kind of pushing all that state, you know, maybe not accessing some, you know, something that's at the class level, or not accessing this or that, kind of making all the dependencies inputs.
So I know like languages like Haskell will actually, I think it's Haskell, but it will actually prevent you from writing a function or an object structure that mutates state unless you make it a certain type of object. Does Scala do that? And could you explain that a little bit better? Because I know that I barely understand what's going on.
Yeah. So that's I think it gets to the heart of the issue. So yeah, in Haskell, it's required. In Scala, it's more of an optional thing, but there is an IO type. And so things that have to access the outside world will be wrapped in this IO type. And this is kind of, if you think, oh, I want to write a pure function, but I need to read this file from disk, how can I write that in a way in which it will get the same result every time, right? And so there's a trick that Haskell uses and Scala as well, which is if instead of my function taking a file name and then going to disk and retrieving the results and returning that, if I instead return a little program that takes the user input but doesn't actually run until I say to run it, then my function is still pure. So in effect, you're basically saying instead of doing the IO action, just return something that will do that in the future. And that's kind of the trick of it. I don't know if that's helpful at all.
No, I mean, it kind of makes sense. So they've got like, I guess for lack of a better explanation, like built-in asynchronous actions that can read from a file or put something on the screen. And instead of your application doing that, you use their built-in functions for that. And then that makes it okay.
Yeah, well, you can think of it, that is on the right track. So in Scala, I use a async library called cats.io, right? And if I want to go make a request out somewhere, I will get and retrieve an integer from a web service, let's say. My function that does that will return an IO int rather than an int, right? And that IO int actually doesn't do anything until somewhere further in my program, I say dot run on it. And then it goes out and performs the action and returns the result. And there's simple ways to kind of chain these and combine these. But that means that in fact, the function that went out to the web service, it is in fact still a pure function because it didn't actually go out to the web service. It just returned kind of instructions for how to do that. So it's a bit hand wavy, but it's a way, like I was describing before, to take all the kind of non-pure functional stuff and push it to the very edges of your program. So it's just at the very end when you're like run and all these things actually happen.
Yeah, I would imagine that things like, pulling from the database, it's like those extreme edges where you're serving something up, maybe you're writing something out, displaying something on a screen, storing something or retrieving it out of the database. But it seems like even non-functional, applications that are written in non-functional languages could really take a lot of that benefit of pushing, and keeping more true to more pure functions in that center. That seems to me that seems to be a way to help make testing easier. You have inputs and outputs, and there's less things to abstract away, and you don't have these mocking states that you're having to keep up. But then on those fringes where the applications are sort of touching, that's where, it's going to get hairy again. And you just got to deal with that.
Yeah, totally. Right. Like you don't have to program in Haskell. You can just take this as a design, like a constraint on your design that will force you to write better software the same way, TDD people really like to talk about. But I like this way better.
I don't know what you're talking about with the TDD thing. That's
yeah. I've spent a lot of time with like the F sharp folks, and I even had a roommate at a conference last year who was big, heavy into F sharp. And I know that C sharp 8 is going to be stealing a lot more of the concepts from F sharp. So I think we're all kind of coming together and picking the best parts of all the languages and figuring out ways to that everyone can benefit.
Yeah, there was a rejected proposal to the F sharp language to add like a pure keyword where like if you said pure, then it would like this had to be pure type of thing, right? Which I think is getting at that idea, right? That they want to like explicitly segregate, like here's all my good stuff and here's my messy deal with the world stuff.
I think they should have had like that be the default, and then like unpure, just like unsafe. You know, like in C sharp, you got to do unsafe if you want to go and manipulate pointers and stuff. So they could have had unpure, and then that's basically, this is effectively an unsafe function because it's manipulating state outside of itself.
Yeah. So Haskell takes this approach, and they have a function called like unsafe coerce IO or something. And that's kind of like, don't look, bad things are happening here type of thing.
There be dragons.
I think it's useful, right? Like, because, you know, if from the outside it looks like a pure function, but maybe you're doing something in the middle, but it, you know, that should never come out. Like, maybe you can hide that a little bit, like an optimization, right? You might build some sort of list manipulation thing that seems pure, but maybe there's some hairy details that.
Do you use a lot of function composition, like building really, really tiny functions and then attaching them together to get your complicated end result?
Totally, yeah.
Okay, cool. I'd love to see some of that in different languages.
Yeah, I mean, like really all a function can do is compose with another function. Like, I mean, you know, it takes an input and returns a result, which you can feed into another function. And then that's, yeah.
All right, so as primarily a C-sharp kind of .NET guy, line of business applications, that is scared of change sometimes. You know, I typically reach for the tools that I'm most comfortable with to solve a particular problem. And it just so happens that the particular problem is the same one I've solved with these tools for years and years. What are the types of problems that functional programming just really excels at? Why would I reach for a Scala or a Haskell or an F sharp?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that if the reliability of the software is very important, that is an area where you see Haskell used a lot, because it has a very advanced type system. You're not going to accidentally be reading things from file or you know, it's very rigorous in terms of what you can do and what you can't do. So that's a place I think it gets used a lot in industry, is where this can't go wrong for sure. But there's lots of other domains where, you know, it's pretty common. Like I write web apps using Scala like day in and day out. So parsers are very commonly written in an FP style. And I don't know if that's because the academics who are interested in functional programming are also the ones building the languages. There's some sort of like virtuous loop there. I don't think that there's domains where it's not a good fit, but I'm biased, I guess. Like, I think this local reasoning that I was talking about, you know, I think that's really valuable, especially for like maintenance of software, right? So maybe that's a good case. If you're certain that this is a prototype that you're going to throw away, like go crazy with your JavaScript. But if you think you're going to have to fix a bug in this 4 years from now, maybe you want some functional programming.
So it sounds like it's more just use what you know and you're comfortable with what you know. And you just happen to be a functional programming guy. I happen to be a C-sharp guy, for better or worse, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I need to spend a little bit more time digging into functional programming and picking out the good parts and figuring out how I can really benefit for that.
It's all good parts.
I don't know. Some of the terminology loses me. I think that's like the biggest barrier to learning functional programming, is you get hit with all these, you know, they're mathematical terms or science terms, but you know, I didn't go to college, so none of that makes any sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is a place where people could, you know, work on improving things. That like, we're probably a bit early in the adoption, especially of some of these things. So like, just, you know, if you're learning it from somebody who did it as part of their master's thesis or something, like it's not going to be expressed in the way that you would expect, but that's got to improve, right? Like at one time, like the async stuff that every language seems to have right now was quite a theoretical, you know, concept.
Well, and somebody could just say, you know, like, don't manipulate state. Ta-da.
Yeah.
So would you have any advice to people who are just trying to get started and maybe they're investigating functional programming, looking for a language to become familiar with, you know, Scala, Haskell, something else? What kind of words of wisdom would you put to them?
Okay, so I got a podcast. I got to plug it. it's called Co-Recursive, and it's not all about functional programming. But it does kind of get maybe at the more academic side of computer science, talk to experts and stuff. But honestly, my advice for somebody new is to sort of find an interest that is outside of kind of what you do in your day job, but is still related to like software development. You know, like a side project or going to meetups or maybe learning an unrelated piece of technology. And I just think that's because like some of that original, you know, like fun I had building that Yahtzee app, like some of that gets squashed a little bit when you have deadlines and bugs and whatever. So you got to keep that excitement and flame alive. So I think it's good to have a side thing.
How about people who might want to follow you? You mentioned your podcast. Do you have any other social media plugs that you can put out there?
Yeah. So I'm on Twitter at Adam Gordon Bell. I think you can just Google my name, Adam Gordon Bell. But yeah, I think the podcast and Twitter are probably the main places.
Yeah. Thanks, Adam. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you. It's been great.
That was Adam Gordon Bell. Adam is a software engineer that loves building software and learning things. He is based in Peterborough, Canada, but works remotely with developers all over the world.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes, and be sure to join us on Slack.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at SixFigureDev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.